This is a Collider.com audio interview.
I just gotta ask, did you run into any motherfucking snakes down in the motherfucking south?
Well, you know, it's the south, there's snakes. I heard there was some around I didn't see.
Did you know you have a voice for the blues? No, because you do.
No, you know, fortunately, Mississippi Delta blues doesn't necessarily need a silky smooth Luther Vandross type voice. So it's kind of more about making sure the emotion of what you're saying comes out than being a great singer. So it helped a lot.
Did Craig play guitar?
I learned to play. It was one of the things that I spent the most time doing. Well, fortunately, I had maybe 6 or 7 months to work that out, and I had a really good guitar teacher in the beginning, Felicia Collins in New York, while I was shooting Freedom Land. And then when I left to go do Snakes on a Plane in Vancouver, the prop master was an awesome guitarist, so he spent a lot of time with me in my trailer every day. So it was something that I did daily, constantly, for 6 or 7 months until I was comfortable doing it. And it actually became something I looked forward to doing every day. So by the time we got to the film, I was pretty facile, and I'd actually taught myself to play the songs in a very different way than Scott played them, because I'd watch him play them, and I'd go, well, I worked it out like this, and he'd watch me play it, and go, I never thought of doing it that way. But then I talked to all these old blues guys when we were doing our little road tour, and most of them had taught themselves to play after 30, and they all had very different playing styles, so I created something that was actually my own in terms of how I learned to play and work my way through the songs. According to Big Jack, I said, oh, that's really cool, you got it. So I was like, thank you.
Lazarus seems to be a man between two worlds, because he's a guy who's been certainly had his knocks and been through the times in his part of the world where a black man couldn't hold his head up the way he does. He's able to now. So I wonder about his choice of taking in Ray rather than just getting her to a hospital and saying, I don't want to have anything to do with this white
man. Yeah, well, interestingly enough, I mean, I understand the choice just because, you know, I understand the rural South because I spent a lot of time in it when I was a kid. And my grandfather's brothers were farmers, and I spent time on the farm when I was a kid with them, walking through the fields and working and hanging out. But there are instances where you find yourself in a circumstance, and if you put her in your truck and you take her to a hospital, there are a lot more questions than if you just keep her at your house and try and nurse her back to health and hopefully she'll walk away. And that choice that he made of keeping her there, very kind of, I mean, you know, he was sort of out of his mind in another kind of way at that point. I mean, he lost this woman that he had no control over. And all of a sudden he has a woman, and she's kind of out of control in that interesting sort of immoral way that he pictured his wife. And he wanted to control her and fix her in another way. So the only way he could think to do that was to, you know, put this chain on her and still give her some amount of freedom and kind of pump this biblical medicine into her, you know, which is, you know, it's interesting that it's not in the film, but we shot a lot of stuff where he's reading the Bible to her in different times, and like when he puts her in the tub for the first time, he's sitting there on the floor, he starts to read to her, and she's in the tub, and then there are times when she's laying on the sofa and he's reading to her, and then there are times where she's eating and he's reading to her, but all that stuff is gone for some reason. But, you know, the time frame seems kind of off, because I don't know how you see it, but in our cinematic minds, when we shot it, she was at his house over a month. You know, now it looks like she's there a couple of days.
The Bible, because, I mean, the Bible's there. We see it opened up, but that would have added a different dimension.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Speaking of the Bible, how did you enjoy being the voice of God?
It's all right. It was fun in the moment I was doing it. It was kind of something that just happened, because I actually went there to read something else, and all of a sudden, you know, it's like, well, we kind of do this thing, and it's like, well, read some of this, and I did, and then we read the rest of it, and the rest of it, and it just kind of went off.
Is it easy to act with a beautiful woman who's almost naked and has a big chain on her? I mean, add a different dimension to the...
Well, you know, after about I guess an hour of looking at Christina in those little panties and that shirt, you kind of get over it, you know, because that was what she had on every day, and she just kind of, she didn't put on a robe or anything between shots and hide herself. She just kind of hung out. So you get over it pretty quickly. The great thing was that during the rehearsal period, Christina and I, you know, developed this really interesting bond and this interesting trust, which kind of allowed her to kind of go anywhere she wanted to, and I would support her in that. To the point where, I guess, as an actor or as Samuel L. Jackson, I became another sort of Lazarus figure in terms of, you know, writers and directors write things, and then when they see it on its feet, it takes on a whole nother life, and then when they see how far two people who put life in it can go, all of a sudden they go, oh my God, I didn't realize it was that. Well, let's try this, and then you have to go, no, we don't need to try that because we're already in this place, and if you do that, then you go too far. Plus, there are things in here that are hard and they have sharp edges, and Christina just kind of goes. So, you know, if you do that, then she's going to break a toe or something's going to fall and you're going to hit her in the head, and then we won't be able to work, so let's not do that.
What made you fall in love with this particular character?
Well, the complexities of who he is, and like I said, he seems to be an amalgam to me of my grandfather and his brothers, you know, guys that I worked with in the fields and talked to and people of the earth who, you know, drank hard when it was time to drink, and they loved the blues and they sang and they told stories and they did all this stuff. And it's kind of like an interesting way for me to pay homage to some men that, you know, developed me in that particular way that made me want to be a storyteller.
What can you tell us about Justin Timberlake? Was he a better actor than what you were expecting? Was he good?
That's loaded. The interesting thing to me about Justin is it would have been easy for him to choose something that allowed him to be more Justin Timberlake, because, you know, guys, especially young guys, don't tend to want to portray people who have frailties and are less than macho. So it's, you know, an interesting choice for him to choose a character that's so opposite of who most women or guys would want their heroes to be. And, you know, he wasn't afraid to do it. He stepped in there and he, you know, gave it his best shot. And it works for me in the film.
You doing the voice of Afro Samurai, is that a similar process to The Incredibles?
Yeah. You know, you just go into a studio and you kind of read the stuff and you kind of do it, and you do it in kind of different spaces in time. All of a sudden somebody will call and it's like, oh, we need you to come to the studio and do some more stuff, so you do it. And fortunately, that, you know, project lent itself to me having two different voices and being a producer and doing all this other stuff, and I guess it's been relatively successful because they've ordered another season, so hopefully we'll get it done.
You see a lot of yourself in Afro Samurai?
I see more of myself in Ninja, apparently. That's the most talkative voice. Yeah.
You shot The Cleaner in Shreveport, is that right?
Shooting The Cleaner in Shreveport. Yeah, I'm going back to tonight. Yeah.
The portraits of the South that we're getting in films today, and Blacksnake Mona, I think, is part of that, are a little bit, I mean, we're seeing a difference. We have this kind of the image, the stereotype that it was reinforced by the films of the last, let's say, 20 or so years.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's getting a fairer shake when you're there? Are people more comfortable with the idea that you're going to portray them well?
Well, actually, The Cleaner is set in New Jersey. So they're making an effort to shoot things that look more Jersey-like than Southern.
So is New Jersey getting a fair shake? I guess that's the movie illusion, but people are comfortable with...
Well, they're just glad that, you know, there are a lot of people that are working. There are about five films shooting in Shreveport right now, you know, so it's a very busy time in the town, and there are like four or five more coming in the next month. So apparently the incentives that Louisiana is giving the film companies and the right-to-work state and not having to worry about unions in that particular way is very appealing to a lot of people.
What did Craig tell you about this character? And then what did you tell him about this character?
Craig didn't tell me anything about the guy, actually. Once I got the script and I read it, and, you know, then they went through all the machinations of, you know, that's not who you're supposed to send the script to, and okay, I'll go meet him and whatever. And Craig saw me on television talking about my life and decided, oh, well, he's got enough. layers in his life to be able to play this guy. I'm an actor that shows up to rehearsal with a lot of stuff. You know, I sit down and I work out things about characters and, you know, put together biographies and histories and all kinds of stuff. So by the time we got there and we started the rehearsal period, it was very smart of him to just sit and watch me and Christina kind of go through what we were going through and figuring out, you know, how our relationship worked and what two people who have no idea of the kind of people that they've encountered, because she'd never met anybody like me that she couldn't sexually manipulate, and I never met anybody or understood what a sexual dysfunction like that was. I mean, how many men, well, I guess a country guy who was a farmer who was playing the blues for a while or been in clubs, he probably ran into some pretty wild women in his day. But, you know, when people talk about nymphomania, you know, people talk about it, but how many people know that they've actually run into a real nymphomaniac or a sexually dysfunctional person? I mean, you don't know how to handle it or exactly what it is. And to him, she was just somebody who was possessed by a devil or evil, and the only thing he knew to do was exercise it.
Some actors say that if a role scares them or a part scares them initially, that they know it's right. Do you go through that process, or are you beyond all that?
Fear? No, I'm always anxious to jump in there and kind of figure out who a person is and where they're coming from and what they're doing. It's part of the challenge and, you know, part of the, I guess, fascination of exploring the human condition for me. To be able to safely walk into spaces that are dangerous and know that it's a controlled environment and not have to worry about being damaged by it in the end. But kind of finding or looking back and seeing, have I seen anybody like that? Have I talked to anybody like this? What was their process? Or how did I perceive their process to be? Because it's all make-believe. And you make up anything you can, you know, to help make a character fuller for me. And, you know, Lazarus had a lot of stuff going on. I mean, he led a life, a pretty wild life, and he gave that life up when he got married and became this farmer, which was not what that woman married. She married somebody, you know, who was in a high life, who was kind of lively, and he bored her. And she left, and he had no understanding of that whatsoever, because he viewed himself as a great provider, and, you know, I kept the house warm, and I kept you fed, and I did this, but she needed more. And he had no conception of that and didn't understand that his music was what made him a person who was alive in a real sense. And once he got back to it, he got back to what made him feel better about himself.
Is this a misogynist film?
I don't know. Well, I mean, there are a lot of films that you can call misogynist, or I think that Christina's performance is one of the bravest performances I've seen that a young actress would, you know, take. And I'm sure there are a lot of young women that probably wouldn't touch this thing. I saw audition tapes for, I guess, maybe three or four different women. But like I said, we talk about sexual dysfunction and we talk about nymphomania, but we never see what that process is. And it's kind of interesting watching whatever this thing is that internally takes her over. And the way she succumbs to it all the time rather than fighting it. She says no, 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 but she always kind of lets go and lets it happen, and not realizing that her power is in resisting it. I don't know. It's titillating, you know. It's not often that you see a young actress in that state of undress two-thirds of a film. You know, it's very kind of early Helen Mirren in that, you know. So I used to like watching Helen Mirren's young lady films because she was always naked. I don't know. Misogynist? I don't know. Titillating? Yes.
Are you going to hop up in Die Hard 4?
No.
No.
How about Lazarus's reaction when he realizes what happened to Lincoln? It was sort of the way you'd like your father to react if you know you were in that situation. But I thought he really handled it in an unusual way.
Well, not in the beginning. You know, he kicked him in the ass and kicked him out of the house and did all that other stuff. And then, you know, when you think about it, you go to the bar and you have this little conversation with him. In fact, there was this interesting little ad lib that Craig had in the first cut and then he took out of the film, which was kind of funny because we had that whole conversation about, yeah, you know, wow. Very nice, and the last thing I said to him was, white girl too. Which we all thought was funny, but then I don't know why Craig took her out. But you know, men talk to their sons differently than, you know, they talk to their daughters, you know, in an interesting sort of way. You always expect your sons to go through that rite of passage, and I guess if they share their first sexual experience with you, you can be kind of proud of them in a way. You know, they've made it through that, or they've crossed that threshold.
You talked to John about producing movies and while you were doing this or afterwards. I mean, is that the kind of thing that... Is that the kind of thing that you do, talk about producing or talk about maybe directing or...
No.
No?
No. I produce movies, you know, on my own already, so, you know, talking to John about producing, well, John produces a certain kind of film, and I mean, I guess he's kind of hands-on. I never watched he and Craig interact when they were talking about what was going on. I knew they were having those conversations, but I was busy trying to figure out what I was going to do and whatever scene. Producing, you know, it's a different kind of animal. A lot of people do it in different ways. You know, some people do it in a hands-off way. Some people are very hands-on. I never perceived myself as an intrusive producer. You know, I have conversations with people about, you know, time and what we're going to do on a particular day and how much time we plan to spend doing this, that, or the other, and how it's all going, or looking at dailies and talking about, you know, fixing stuff. But, no, it's all very different.
And this film, as most of the other films, you always have a different hairstyle. Is that your choice to the hairpiece?
Lazarus?
Yes.
Well, yeah. Well, Craig actually wanted me to look a lot like R.L. Burnside, who actually died when we were shooting. And that's sort of what he looks like. And it's also sort of what my grandfather's brothers look like. So, yeah, it was a conscious choice to have that receding hairline and have white hair and make him older and kind of lived in and walk like he carries a lot of weight, you know, around on his shoulders. And just kind of, you know, farmers are very strong and vital kind of guys, but, you know, they don't move very fast because they kind of conserve their energy.
Why do you think his wife left him and everybody in town had that get-by attitude?
Well, she wanted more. She wanted more out of life. She wanted more fun in her life. She wanted more excitement and vibrancy, and Lazarus was not providing that. She kind of felt like she was on that farm, stuck, isolated, not going anywhere, not doing anything, and she wanted another kind of life. And apparently his brother was going to provide that for her.
Could you talk about other projects you've done since Black Snake Moon through what you're working on now?
What have I done since then?
About 1408.
Oh, yeah, right. Black Snake Moon. We're from Black Snake Moon to... Oh, from Black Snake Moon to... I guess I went to... No, I didn't go to John. Oh, I did Freedom... Home of the Brave. Yeah, Home of the Brave was next. I still don't know when they're going to release it, even though it was in limited release around Christmas. The story about the soldiers coming home from Iraq with Jessica Biel and 50 Cent. After that, I did 1408. Yeah, 1408. Yeah, last summer. Which is, I saw the trailer for it. It looks pretty good. Yeah.
Can you tell us about your character?
I'm just a hotel manager who's trying to prevent this guy from staying in that room because he doesn't believe in paranormal experiences, even though he writes about them. He's never actually seen a ghost, and that room is purely evil. But he has to go into that to find that out. So that and trying to prevent him from doing that. It's not a big role. It's just sort of expository, talking about all the deaths that have happened in the room and why he shouldn't stay in it. And then I went to Jumper, which I'm still shooting, actually, which is a film about kids that can teleport, and I play a government agent that's sort of chasing them and killing them and kind of hates kids that can do that because they leave these interesting rips in the atmosphere when they do it. That's still kind of going on, so I'm back and forth still shooting stuff in that. What else is there? Seems like there's something else I'm missing. Cleaner I'm doing now. Yeah, Cleaner I'm doing now, which is about a guy who cleans death sites. Interestingly enough, after police finish with crime scenes or people die in a house or whatever, it's up to the family to clean the house up, you know, get the brains off the wall and the blood off the floor, and something I didn't know. I always thought they did it. But this guy runs a business that does that. And he also cleans up other kinds of biohazards with animals and that kind of stuff. And it's about a guy who actually gets a call from the police, and he goes and he cleans up a crime scene site. And a couple of days later, he's looking in the paper, and the house that he cleaned up, the husband's missing, and the woman, wife doesn't know what happened. And it's kind of like he realizes that somebody duped him into cleaning up a crime scene that the police don't know about yet. So now he's got to figure out what to do. Does he tell him? Does he try to figure out who did it or whatever? And the wife kind of comes to him because he accidentally took her key and went back to the house. That's that. And I'm supposed to do a film called Blackwater Transit after that. And after that, I'm supposed to do a film called Lakeview Terrace, which is about a racist cop who kind of harasses this interracial couple that moves into his neighborhood. I don't know what I'm doing after that. What? Oh, Resurrecting the Champ. That's what I did. Oh, duh. Yeah, Resurrecting the Champ, a film I did with Josh Hartnett about a homeless fighter that this reporter discovers and starts writing about his life and telling his story because he wants to be as famous as his father was, who was a famous journalist. And nice little story.
When is my time for golf?
I have a golf clause in my contract. They have to let me play twice a week.
How long did you say the chain was?
How long? 30, 40 feet. I mean, she could get she could go all over the house chained to it, and you saw how far she could get out in the yard with it on. So it's relatively long, and Christina insisted on wearing a real chain all the time, so relatively heavy, too.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Can I follow up while you're signing that? 30th anniversary of Star Wars. Are you going to do anything for... they're doing some big Star Wars convention here in L.A. Have they asked
really?
You?
No, nobody's called me. Not yet.